So it's a nice week out there, and some of the smoke that's been around recently seems to have really cleared away.
Yep.
So that's nice.
That's nice. Nice is to see the sun bright again, clear sun, clear skies.
We still had a very red sunset last night, but
yeah, that's awesome to have a red sunset. Also, if you start noticing. And if you wake up and you park your car outdoors, you will see that there is dew on the windshields and on top of your car. So it means that the temperature at night is dropping slowly. Mm-hmm. And that, as the gardeners tells us, that we are in a transition. Yep. Summer is slowly moving into fall. And if you've been living in Vancouver and in Burnaby for a long time, you know that sometimes in 2 weeks, we switch very quick.
Yeah.
And then we are caught. Like, I should have done that because it switched so fast.
Yeah, well, it's funny because, you know, you see that at the beach, right? August, nice day, everybody's at the beach. Labor Day comes, nice day, nobody's at the beach. And it's only a few degrees that makes that difference between what's comfortable and not so great anymore. And
I
imagine that's the same in the garden.
The same in the garden. Yeah, so the plants start noticing. And we also, in our gardens, we start noticing wildlife, which is interesting. So at the moment, there are lots of white cabbage butterflies.
Right.
Flapping around, visiting the garden. It's awesome to see them.
You know, they're very pretty.
Very pretty, and my garden is attracting wildlife. But remember, this time they are also laying eggs because they want to make sure the next generation has to survive for the butterflies.
Yeah.
So they are laying eggs under the leaves. And if now it's time for us gardeners to go and visit your plants, and if you start noticing some small holes in the leaves, it means that there is a caterpillar underneath, and they are so tiny. They start very, very tiny, and the damage is small. So tiny little holes inside the leaf. So that tells us there's a caterpillar. Look underneath, and you see a small, tiny, almost translucent caterpillar.
Yeah.
So we had to start controlling. The only thing that organic, super organic, is take your fingers and squish them.
Right. So once you see those butterflies showing up, you need to start looking for those caterpillars. But also the eggs, you can find the eggs as well.
The eggs. Yeah. Any eggs that you see at the moment, just squish it. Because it could be eggs of butterflies or the eggs of aphids, because they are also slowly start to showing up. We have beautiful Savoy cabbage. And if you have grown Savoy cabbage, you know how wrinkly the leaves are.
Yeah.
Very nice and difficult to apply any pesticide or any insecticide. So even if you apply insecticidal soap, it will just wash away. So you have to use your hand and prevent that the caterpillars have a feast of your vegetables. So we just noticed that we have those caterpillars in Savoy cabbage, kale, and radishes, in the leaves of radishes. And if we don't control, we can just lose all our radishes, and particularly in a week time, everything will be gone. That's one thing. The other thing is that we had beautiful, beautiful sunflowers in the garden. Beautiful, big sunflowers. They bloomed, and now they were setting seeds.
Yep.
But nature, looking for food. Every creature in the wild is looking for food, fatting it up for the winter. So those sunflowers are a source of nutrition. So they came and they climbed up and they ate all the seeds. So you can see the holes on the ground.
Yeah.
And they were not only happy with that also the fleshy part of the flower as well. They munched on that. And some plants didn't stand, the stems didn't stand the weight of squirrels, so they snapped in half. So everything's on the ground, and then you can see the leftovers of their feast that they have. So, so again, if you were planning to have seeds of sunflowers for the next season, it would have been better if you covered those sunflowers with a kind of mesh or paper bag or a tissue bag in order to collect the seeds and as well prevent the visitors enjoy it.
Yeah. I imagine that creates a problem too. Because, I mean, they must miss some seeds, and those end up in the ground, and you know, and you end up with errant sprouts next spring.
Yeah, so next spring we might have some sunflowers growing around the garden bed.
Yeah.
The other thing, at the moment, I'm just being positive, like squirrels.
Yeah.
But very much can be rats and mice. And again, we don't want to invite those creatures into our garden. So we have to be very careful that we don't, the garden doesn't become a source of food for the wildlife.
And so what can you do to prevent that? I mean, you know, I see, you know, people, they put, for deer anyway, you know, they put a tall fence around. But what can you do for a squirrel or other smaller creatures like that?
Okay, so at the moment there is a product that you can buy that is a combination of mint oil, there is pepper oil. It's kind of a granulate that you can spread around the plant, and hopefully that deters, because it affects the sense of the smell.
Unpleasant smell.
So chili, pepper, it's not the nicest. And most of the rodents and wildlife, they depend on their nose. So that would be one option. The other option would be spraying with a solution of concoction of chili peppers and garlic.
Right.
It's very, very... not tasty, but very spicy when you chew on that.
Yeah.
So that would be as well another deterrent for preventing that. Right. Your beautiful flowers being raided by the wildlife. So this we notice in the garden. And finally, as well, we are noticing that all the flowers, for instance, the cat's ear, which is a wild flower similar to the dandelion, is in bloom again.
Right.
So it will flower, and seed will be created and it's dispersed all over the gate. So
does it create the same sort of, you know, ball like a dandelion does?
They do, yes. Yeah. This puff ball, yes. Yeah. So and that will be seeds all over the place. So again, time to control the weeds. So we don't want to have extra work done over the next spring. And our apple trees, one of our apple trees have problems with spider mites. So they have, you will see very characteristic, is part of the branch of the leaves, they are covered with a web, cobweb, and all that you can see, and they are tiny little creatures just crawling.
So it's very similar to looking to like what you see with tent caterpillars.
So that's like, okay, so now we need to clean, sanitize that with using, I'm planning to use insecticidal soap, and hopefully I can clean the that section of the branch, and hopefully they don't return. So that is another thing. So as you can see, we are moving. The garden is in a transition, and the environment is in a transition. Wildlife try to set themselves for the next generation, for the next season, and we gardeners have to be in a cleaning and janitorial mode constantly. I know that some of us will be like, oh, I had a heavy summer, we've been watering, we've been harvesting, was like, I want the season done. And sometimes we just forget, you know, and then that leaving the garden as it is, it becomes a heavy work for the spring. And so we at the moment are keeping up. And as well, in our minds is already fall is coming, rain will be here, and it's time to start extending the gardening season by building hoop houses. So again, that's another big task. We have this garden, it will be our second winter in on site, and we want to have all the garden beds protected with hoop houses. So we will be building during October. We just build hoop houses, and protecting the garden beds, because they are raised garden beds, protecting them from the excessive rain of the fall.
Excellent. Well, it, you know, as we say every week, it's always busy in the garden, but it's also, you know, sometimes being busy is saving you from extra busyness later on, like a lot of tasks, getting ahead, keeping the garden clean, you know, removing the waste, tidying up the weeds.
Tidying up the weeds, and somehow as well, keeping the wildlife, but selecting which wildlife you like to keep. One thing that we still notice is the deer. The deer has come and eat all the tomato shoots and the shoots of the beans. And it's interesting because they just go for that plant, even though we have corn, which already has beautiful ears, and they haven't touched it. Next to the beans, we have beautiful carrots. They haven't touched it, not even nibble the leaf of the carrot, nothing. And finally, here in the garden here, at the south side of the Maggie Benston, we have a community area, pinny tables. And this side used to have crows. Well, all across campus, there are crows. But this section used to have a bit more concentration of crows. And now I notice in the last 2 weeks, they have become very bold.
Oh, yeah?
So they were bold because they were around, but now they are extremely bold. So if you arrive to a table, to a picnic table, with your lunch, they will just land straight on the table and close and walk towards you.
Yeah. So that's not really, I mean, I like crows, but I wouldn't like that.
No, not like that, because at one point they will start just diving and swiping, sweeping whatever is in your plate. and that we don't want. I remember that if you had visited a few years back the Vancouver Aquarium, mm-hmm. we have the seagulls.
Right.
And then you went to the to collect your food from the counter, until you get to the table, they will just swipe, dive, and take your food.
Yeah.
So we don't want that in here. So and this is open. And so if you are a listener of us and listening to us, please do not feed the wildlife. Do not feed the wild. Don't encourage those crows to be comfortable around us when we are eating, because they are very bold now. They just, as I said, they just land on the picnic table and get closer to you, like, hey, I'm here.
And probably that's good advice in your own garden too, to just, you know, discourage the wildlife you don't want, but don't encourage too much, you know, everyone else to come by and you know, it's not good for the animals anyway.
Yes. So our food is not good for animals. We know very well that bread is not good for birds. Mm-hmm. They don't digest very well the bread, and we still tend to give them bread.
Yeah.
And the other thing is our food has oils, have vinegar, vinaigrettes, dressings. So it's not good for. And the other is they become a nuisance. Mm-hmm. So now in the garden, you just arrive there for a resting place, and suddenly you have all this wildlife crowing, shouting like, oh, I'm here, where's the food? and the deer, I noticed as well, the deer, people walk around and they have offered them carrots, you know, from the hands. The deer gets used to be fed by hand, and sometimes you are just walking around and they just get closer to you and expecting that to be fed, and you have nothing, and then there is not this nice feeling, you know, like the animal gets closer to you and you're like, no, you have to keep your distance. Things like that. Hopefully, we are going to make more signage inviting everyone not to feed the wildlife.
Well, that's great. That's, summer's always busy for so many things, but the garden keeps on gardening.
Yes. And so now we'll be moving to fall. We just started with our cold crops, kale, cabbages, leeks we've been planting. So this is the time. If you've been following us, we've been telling week 26 when the school ends, this is the time to start your nursery. Now we are in week 34, so your nursery will be full of plants ready to transplant, if you haven't been transplanting already. So because in 2 weeks time the school is open and the garden moves into fall completely.
Great. Well, thanks so much, Pablo. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability. He's here every week as our gardens expert. Tell us more about how people can find out about Embark.
So, Embark is a hub of knowledge and supporting members of the SFU community that are interested in sustainability. And we can find our work in visiting our website at embarksustainability.org and following our social media channels at Embark Sustainability.
Great. Thanks so much, Pablo. See you next week.
See you next week.
And Pablo Vimas will be joining us every week until the end of the gardening season in the beginning of November. So tune in every day about 10:30 to get all the great garden wisdom from there. Don't forget that coming up, lots of great programming coming up here on CJSF, Democracy Now! At 11. We'll be back with a report from Danny Nesvadarani right after this message.
Wandering Rhythms, Mondays from noon to 2.
Join us in a weekly sample of music from planet Earth.
The strangest mixtape you will ever hear.
Desert blues.
Balkan punk.
Latin funk.
African psych.
Pigeon rap.
And anything and everything else you can imagine, equally represented by all continents.
Because good music is universal.
Wandering Rhythms.
Mondays at noon on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. The Many Voices Project at the Burnaby Village Museum is working towards including voices and perspectives that haven't had the opportunity to be a part of the city's historical record. Originally starting 4 years ago, the Burnaby Village Museum has recently put a call out for more participants to share their experiences living in Burnaby through oral history interviews as part of this project. Eventually, these interviews will become a part of the city's digital historic archive. To learn more about the project, how Burnaby residents can participate, and why it began in the first place, we reached out to Kay Petrusa, assistant curator at the Burnaby Village Museum. Please take a listen to our conversation.
I think one of the main jobs or roles of any museum is to collect information, stories, artifacts, and preserve those things and share those things, make them accessible. So the Many Voices Project is one way that we do that. We use the term oral history. It's kind of an academic term, but the idea being it's interviews with people who want to share their stories. And it's a really great way to broaden our collection. So we treat these interviews like we would an artifact, like a photograph. They are part of the museum's collection. And they really serve to diversify what we have in our collection. You know, the museum has been around for more than 50 years now. So the way we've collected, the people who've been involved with collecting has really evolved in 50 years. So this is an opportunity to reach groups of people that have not previously contributed to the museum at all, or to maybe a smaller degree. It's accessible to people who may not have a physical item that, you know, is deeply imbued with Burnaby history. I mean, we accept and collect things from all walks of Burnaby time. You know, it's not just old stuff. It's these interviews are examples of new contemporary stories that are relevant for Burnaby's history, for Burnaby's present, for the future. Another reason I really like doing this project is because I often do think into the future. So, you know, for example, we have, I would say, a really sizable collection right now of oral histories. And I love thinking of future curators, researchers, designers who will be able to draw on this really rich collection of like an intensively textured experience of what Burnaby's like right now. And another great thing about it is that people share their contributions, their stories in their own words. So we do contribute, when we have the interview recorded, that audio is available. We also provide a transcript, but having that audio file is just it's very personal. It's in someone's own words, so it's sort of a unique way of capturing history, a rich way to do it.
What was the outreach process like? Like, how do you get people to know that this is an option, this is something that they can contribute to?
Mm-hmm. Lots of ways. We've done, so yeah, I'm proud to say that the project is in its fourth year. And, you know, formally in its fourth year, but the museum has been doing outreach in this way for at least 10. So it sort of started with, at least initially, it started with a group of people that showed an interest in working with the museum. A community such as, well, the Chinese Canadian community came first. There's just, because there was an advisory at the time, an advisory committee, I should say. So a group, a close-knit group of people who had been here a long time and were just interested in sharing their history, getting it documented and sort of in the museum's collection. And it was really successful. And again, we definitely did oral histories. We've got some really great artifacts that came out of that push. And that kind of happened organically. I wasn't at the museum at the time, but that was sort of like the beginnings of it. And since then, there's been different evolutions of working with specific community groups, whether they come forward and say, we're a community, we have something to share, can we share it? The Many Voices Project is a perfect way for that. I mean, we do have other opportunities for really anyone to come forward and be involved with our programs or our community exhibitions call out. But this program I like because it's just always there. It's perennial. It's someone can come forward, an individual can come forward, or a group can come forward. So I guess how we've reached other people in the past, it's been a little bit organic. Sometimes it's been, you know, we also know Chinese Canadian community has been established in Burnaby a long time, but, you know, actually the South Asian community has been established a long time. So why don't we, you know, make a few contacts there? I can't even recall now how exactly that came forward. It might have been a desire on the museum's behalf, with many people very willing to contribute. And the series of oral histories we did during that time actually culminated in an exhibition that was at the museum for 2 years. And so it's kind of, it's happened that way. And I find now, again, that we're this far along. We have a lot of people coming forward now. So it's really, really great to be able to sort of work month in and month out around connecting with these groups. But we also do to what we can on social media, other media such as this, to sort of get the word out. And also we attend community events around Burnaby, you know, Pride and Car Free Day, those kinds of things. So just trying, those are really interesting. We reach a very different group of people when we go out into the community.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, it sounds like people are contributing on their own terms, and that kind of relates to another question I had, which was the, I guess, the format of how these contributions are made, you know, like whether, if it's an interview, for example, whether you have like set questions that you ask, or if it's something that someone has a very specific idea in mind of what they want to talk about, and then they just come to you with that, or if it's a mix of both, maybe.
Yeah, it's a mix of both and everything in between. You know, some people, I find some people who hear about the project are just instantly inspired and say, wow, finally, you know, I have a chance. Or more often it's, you know, a friend of a friend who thinks, you know, you have a really great story, you should tell it. Those people sometimes need a little encouragement around, like, well, they'll wonder, well, what is my story? I don't have a story. I've been here for a while. I like it, you know, so it takes a bit of time to talk those out. So in the case of someone that they're not really sure if it's for them, or they're not really sure if they're the right person, I think the way we kind of define it is, if you have a connection to Burnaby and you want to share it and sort of contribute to the historical records in perpetuity, that's more or less the criteria. So if someone's feeling a little bit like they don't know where to start, we usually meet with the person in advance. So sometimes, you know, media interviews is sort of like you're on and you go. But this is, we often will take the time in advance to just sort of meet with the person first and say, well, what, you know, what, who are you? You know, it's just sort of general life story questions. That's generally how it goes. But in the case of, say, a certain community group, sometimes there is a thread, especially if we know this group of interviews will end up in an exhibition. Sometimes when you know as a community you're working towards an exhibition and you're going to be physically on display in the museum as well as online, we have done more structured interviews. You know, we'll always include sort of the life history, but we also include, you know, sometimes more specific things around, say, for example, if the community is known for textiles or a particular art form, or the community is known for being having come from a war-torn country, like, how much do they want to speak about that? Or are they, as a group, trying to sort of change the narrative that they see in the media or out in the world, that they have the chance to sort of retell it or tell it in a different way or provide a different perspective? So it really depends on the person. I mean, the community collections are nice because it's a really, again, a really deep and rich textured snapshot. But the one-offs are great as well, especially because we've been doing this long enough now that something that comes across as sort of a random happenstance contact is now starting to plug into other stories we have or other collections that we have. So it depends.
Mm-hmm, yeah. So it's like a very broad view of Burnaby in a sense. I mean, both in obviously like the identities that are presented, but then also just in the way that it's presented as well.
Yeah, I mean, currently we're pursuing. So again, we're always pursuing people with a connection to Burnaby, and we're always collecting material for the museum. But at this very moment, we are working with the Armenian community in Burnaby, which has had a cultural center in Burnaby for 50 years, which I hadn't known that previously. And we're also looking for the queer experience in Burnaby. So if there's that one, we know maybe more about Vancouver's queer history, but the Burnaby one is sort of quieter, a little more unknown. So that's been interesting. And also the working waterfront. So Burnaby has Burrard Inlet along the Fraser River, and even Still Creek. They've been industrial areas for about 100 years or so, and so that's kind of a long time. And if you look at the history of like the physical geography or urban geography of Burnaby, it's changed so much in 100 years. But for me, I feel like the physical. The way our waterfronts look and the contributions of industry has really remained relatively stable. Some people might disagree with that, but from sort of an outsider view, from someone who's curious, the physical space and the land use as well has been stable. So we don't know an awful lot about that, but really interested in anyone who's worked on the waterfront, whether it's in along sawmills, logging, energy resources, shipping now. So those are sort of three focuses.
How can people who are interested in just the stories being shared through this access it in the first place?
The easiest way is to go to Heritage Burnaby. You could just Google that phrase and you'll find it. And if you go to our homepage, there's a tile that says Oral History Collection. So you'll get access to our entire what's basically what is available and online and sort of ready to go. So if you want to peruse, you can search by community, you can search by keyword. But the search function is quite good if you know what you're looking for, but it's also not such a huge collection that you could probably just browse, over the few pages. But Heritage Burnaby is the place to go and listen and see what we've done so far.
And right now, there's just an active call for more people to contribute, correct?
Yes, there's always an active call, and those three sort of topics I mentioned, we're especially interested, and there's some momentum there. Yes.
Those were the main questions I had regarding the Many Voices project. But if there's anything we didn't touch on that you think is worth mentioning that people should know about, please do.
Yeah, I think I just like, I sort of already said this, but I just like to underscore that this project is, it's contributing to the museum's collection. I think sometimes people think of museums as basements with old things, which is not untrue. But we do more than that. We're always collecting, we're always sort of trying to record and make contributions to the historical record and share those contributions. So I see that project like that, and I think sometimes that's a little harder and more intangible for people to understand. But also just to encourage people to contact me or contact the museum if you have questions, if you're not really sure, if you want to just kind of explore. Like we interview people that have a connection to Burnaby, so even if you think, oh, I've only been here a year, but I've done all these things and I intend to do these future things. Like that's a wonderful, that works for us. I would just invite people to think about their own stories and how they probably are quite relevant to what we're looking at, because we're looking at Burnaby and we're looking at documenting it now for future historians, researchers, and scholars.
Once again, that was our interview with Kate Petrusa, the assistant curator at the Burnaby Village Museum, on the Many Voices project, which has put a call out for more participants to share their experiences living in Burnaby through oral history interviews, which will then be included in the city's historical record for those to access online. This has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM. This interview would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca.